It's been said that human beings do not generally like to be told what to do. That's probably true in general terms. In fact, you may remember in the book of Genesis, when Lot tried to give some instruction to the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom especially, what did they tell him? They said, "Who made you to be judge over us?" In other words, the bottom line is, don't tell me what to do. I want to be in charge myself. And it's been said about leadership that I don't need to lead as long as everyone else does what I say. It's pretty much the same thing. We've been going through, during the past number of sermons, six to be exact now, a series on the fundamental teachings, fundamental knowledge that comes to us from the book of Genesis. We've been almost all the way through Genesis chapter 1, and we are speeding through the last three verses today. It is amazing to see how much God reveals in the very first few verses of the Bible. And we would like to continue today by wrapping up chapter 1, and maybe even getting to the start of chapter 2. That's not likely, but we'll do the best that we can to do that. Now, what does that have to do with the introduction we just gave? It leads us to point number 18, and that is humans are given dominion. Humans are given dominion. The reason it's important to make this point today is because we have a cultural movement that in essence tries, it seems, to convince young people especially that humans should not have dominion over the earth. Let's take a look at Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26, and I'll explain all those things as we go along. Genesis chapter 1, in verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness." We covered that last time fairly thoroughly, I think, so we won't comment more on that. What was part of being made in God's image? What's the first thing that's mentioned after being told that we are made in the very image and likeness of God? It is this: let them have dominion. Let them have dominion. Dominion is not a word that we use very often today. We don't say to each other, "Well, I have dominion over my job," or "I have dominion over this responsibility. Get out of my kitchen, I have dominion here." We don't say that. What does it mean, the word dominion? It's the Hebrew word radah, and it means to rule. As soon as God said, "Let us make man in our image," what I'm going to do is put him in charge to rule the creation. He says, have dominion over what? The fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle or the livestock, the animals, over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. The word radah means to rule, to have dominion, to dominate. It even means to tread down. Now again, does God want us to tread down the earth? No, but we'll talk about that as we go along. It means to have dominion, to rule. It also can mean to subjugate, to bring under control, to bring under authority. God gave, as a part of his image and likeness, rulership. We said last time how being made in the image and likeness of God meant, in essence, that human beings were a small flesh or dirt copy of God. God rules. He wanted human beings to learn by ruling. Well, when we think about the overall goal of God bringing us into his family, ruling over others, he wanted us to have regular training. As we ruled over this creation, he wanted that to teach us lessons to properly prepare for life in his family. Jacenius's Hebrew commentary or Hebrew lexicon says this: the word radah means to subdue or rule over. We're to learn to be good managers of what we own. How is a Christian to do that today? As part of being made in the image of God, humans are to rule over the earth and the things on the earth. We're to learn to be good managers of what we have. Therefore, Christians keep our homes and our properties clean and maintain. We rule over them. In a very small way, we're subduing and ruling over our portion of the creation. And as a result, we bring glory to God by how we keep our things. We bring glory, or on the other hand, we bring dishonor to God. It requires us to be wise stewards over the creation and manage it well. Now, I mentioned earlier that some in our culture today seem to want to convince people that the creation should not, well, they don't believe it's a creation, number one. It's evolved, but they believe it should never be touched, shouldn't be intervened in at all. It should all be left to be, quote unquote, natural. What is natural? Natural usually means overgrown and a mess and a confusion and of little use. Now, that's not to say that there aren't portions of God's creation that are wild and beautiful. But notice in chapter 2, in verse 15, God's specific instruction to human beings. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15. It says, "The eternal God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to do what?" It says, "To tend and keep it." The King James says, "To dress and keep it." Frankly, I like the word dress because it gives us the concept that we should make it nicer. Dress this up, would you? It means make it nicer. Make the environment nicer. The accommodations nicer. The setting nicer. Tend it and keep it. The Hebrew word for tend is abad, and it means to work. Work it. That same word is used in Exodus 20, verse 9. Where it says, 6 days shall you work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. 6 days shall you tend, shall you work, shall you improve your surroundings, shall you manage your surroundings. It means to work, to serve. More often than not, this Hebrew word, avad, means, it is translated as the word, English word, serve. So we are actually to serve creation by tending it. Now the New King, or the New International Version, some other translations, New American Standard, use the word to cultivate. The Lord God put the man in the garden to cultivate and keep it, to tend it. We have a responsibility that while the creation is beautiful and it's intricate and it's interdependent and it's an interconnected work of art designed by the great Creator God, man can and should improve it by working it, by tending it, by cultivating it. So those who say all of this human contact has ruined the creation simply don't know what they're talking about. Now, that's not to say that mankind hasn't made some really stupid mistakes in dealing with the creation. We all could list those very easily, no doubt. At the same time, we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We can improve and beautify or dress or cultivate our part of the creation. Too often, human contact has degraded the creation rather than improved it. But the command that God gave is take dominion. Take what you are responsible for and make it better. Make it nicer. Improve it. Tend it. Work it. Cultivate it. Do not neglect it. And that's hard work. When God said, "You will earn your bread by the sweat of your brow," anyone who owns, my father-in-law would always say, "You own a house, you own a hobby." Now, I don't think that's correct. You own a house, you own a lot of work. It's not a hobby. It's all the time. Something's got to be done. And either you do it or you pay somebody else to do it. But it's important to tend the creation that we have personal responsibility for. And again, sometimes That's a difficult concept for us to grasp. And depending on our background, we may have been raised in a situation where simply that was not a value that was held by our family. Well, it is something that needs to be held by our families. It needs to be something that God is reflected in our part of the creation, what we are responsible for. Christians have a responsibility to work, to improve, and to protect the creation as a whole, but especially the part of the creation that we are responsible for personally. Now, some have in our generation, and certainly generations before, but it seems much more so prevalent these days, some twist this to become earth worship. That we should worship Mother Earth and care for her. Wait a second. Earth is not my mother, thank you very much. But you see, when you have an evolutionary viewpoint, then yes, Earth is my mother, because out of this soup somehow, I sprung. Therefore, the Earth is my mother. Where does that come from? It comes from pure paganism. It's pure earth worship. It's pure Satanism is what it boils down to. It is the New Age kind of concept. At least it's called New Age now. It's very old age, but it's called New Age now. So we don't want to begin to think in that term that, all we have to do is leave the earth alone and it'll be fine. Well, that's simply not true. The earth can be beautified and improved, and God expects us, as we work the creation, He expects us to build character, learn lessons, appreciate Him and His creative ability all the more. Now, the problem, of course, with some today is that maybe it would be best stated this way. We do not dress and keep the earth because we value the earth. I'll state that again. We do not dress and keep the earth because we value the earth. Now, that may sound like a shocking statement. And that's what a lot of people out there think. Oh, we love Mother Earth. We must care for her. No. Let me finish the statement. We do not dress and keep the earth because we value the earth. We dress and keep it because we value God who created it. It's an important distinction. It may not sound like much of a distinction, but it is a very important distinction. One view puts the earth first. We must care for the earth. Puts the earth first. Wrong priorities. The other view puts God first, and the earth is His property, His creation. So we care for the earth because we honor God, because we value God. It's His property. We value His property because we value Him. Therefore, we take care of the earth. We must worship the Creator first and foremost and value His creation. We don't value the earth because it's the earth. We value it because it's God's creation. We honor God. Therefore, we want to care for His creation. Now, certainly much more could be said. As we've mentioned many times, human contact on the earth has only sullied it and dirtied it because we have not dressed and kept it. We have not cultivated it. We have not worked it properly or served it. See, it is possible to work the land and serve it and have it serve you. Often human contact has been the opposite. So I'm certainly not saying that we should be of the mind that do whatever you want to the earth, it'll be fine. Because that's simply not true. In fact, when Christ returns, one of the things that's stated in the book of Revelation is that He's going to destroy those who destroy the earth. Well, not because the earth is our mother, but it's because it's God's property. And if one thinks so poorly of God that we mistreat His property, then they have to be dealt with. Now, we can easily understand that on the physical level. If I let you use my car, or you let me use your car, and I run it into the ground, smash it in a telephone pole, and return it to you and say, well, thanks for letting me use your car. What does that tell me about how you value me? Well, not very well, obviously. You don't value my stuff, so you must not value me. So again, the approach is we value the earth because it's God's creation. We honor God, therefore we value what He's created. So that should be pretty clear. Let's go on then to number 19. We said we try to finish Genesis chapter 1 this time, so we'll move along. Again, much more could be said about tending the earth, dressing it, our own personal responsibility toward our belongings, how our environment should reflect godliness as to the best of our ability. That's all very true. But let's go on to number 19. Men and women are spiritually equal before God. Men and women are spiritually equal before God. In today's world, that may not sound like much of a shocking statement, but in the ancient world, when this was written by Moses, it was a completely, unbelievably unique way of thinking. Because up till very recently, women were the property of the men who owned them, the men who married them. They were property. They were part of the household that the man owned. So when God at the very beginning said in Genesis 1 verse 27, something different, it was really would have been a shocking statement at the time. Genesis 1 verse 27. So God created man. Again, the word is Adam. It means mankind, humankind. God created humans, we might say, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. So he almost makes it idiot proof. He says it in verse 26, let us make man in our image and our likeness. Then in verse 27, he says, oh, by the way, men and women are in the image of God, and I created them in the image of God. But then he says this, male and female, he created them. God specifically designed male and female. Both are in the image of God. When it says he created man in his own image, again, the word means humanity in general. It's the same word. Sometimes that word Adam is a single individual, the first man created, the first male created. Other times it's used to represent all of humanity. So in this case, both men and women were created in the image of God. Now it's interesting. We wonder, what other attributes does God have? Does he have male attributes? Does he have female attributes? If you were to look at God, what would you see? The answer is, that's a good question. I don't know. Nonetheless, some of the things that God has created, he placed within women. Some of his attributes are more strongly represented in women than they are in men. Some of his attributes are more strongly represented in males as opposed to females of humans. Now, which of those is the case? We're not told. But what we understand, and the important aspect, is that both have the same value before God. Both have the same spiritual potential. Both are designed to be children in the family of God. Notice, if you would, you might take out your 3x5 and put it here in Genesis 1. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. It may seem odd to jump all the way to the epistles of Paul from Genesis chapter 1. But Paul makes a statement here about the people of God coming out of the world being different. 2 Corinthians 6, we'll begin reading in verse 14. Become not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. He's talking about how Christians need to be separate from the world. Doesn't mean we don't have anything to do with people in the world, but we shouldn't be awkwardly tied together with people who are not of the same faith. It makes it very difficult. Whether it's marriage, whether it's business opportunities, etc., can unequally yoke us in a difficult way. Don't become unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? What fellowship or communion has light with darkness? What agreement has Christ with Belial, or what part has he that believes with an infidel? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I'll dwell in them, walk in them, I will be their God, they shall be my people. And verse 17 is where we'll focus on, where he says, therefore, come out from among them, be separate, says the Eternal. Do not touch what is unclean, and I'll receive you. Verse 18, I will be a father to you. And then he says this, and you shall be my sons and daughters. Sons and daughters. Now again, in our generation, the concept of women being equal before God seems to be a given. But it's very important to state, because there are many cultures still today in existence around the world who don't believe that for a second. That God says that you'll be equal, sons and daughters. They don't believe that. In fact, there are many in the Middle East who might want to strap on a belt and blow themselves up because their reward is going to be what? You probably all heard that. You know, the 50 virgins in heaven. Excuse me. That makes women property once again. That's the cultural norm there. It's sad and it's wrong, but that's the idea. So what we find is that it was unique in the ancient world for women to be valued, to be considered the spiritual equals of men. Paul was radical as well when he wrote this very thing. You will be the sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. God himself designed men and women to be spiritual equals, to become children of his, to become members of his family. That's an exciting proposition. Now, it gives us responsibility on both accounts. There was a time in the church that we would have encouraged our young ladies to remember that they too will be rulers in the kingdom of God. That time has passed because our culture now already constantly reminds them or teaches them that you're actually in charge anyway. You're far smarter than those idiots you're married to. Now, does that sound like that's extreme? Or do we see that every day, any TV commercial you watch, who's the idiot? It's the man. So rarely do we have to say, ladies, you realize your potential is amazing. Because they've been taught that now for about 30, 35 years in our culture, probably 40 years now. So much so, what do we have to do on the other hand? Fellas, stand up and be the man. Take your role. You are to be the leader. In fact, we've been asked to teach a class at Foundation Institute on that very topic. Teaching men to be men. Making sure they understand their responsibility and role to lead. Lead in the relationship at home. Lead in the church. Lead in society. It's a value that is quickly being lost to things like homosexuality, to metrosexuality, problems along the way. There is a responsibility of our men to lead. So again, that's an entirely different topic than we want to cover, but it's something that's very heavy on me right now because we see such a sad abrogation of authority and responsibility amongst our men. And it's simply, well, whatever you want to do, sweetheart. Well, excuse me. No, it's not. You have a job here. You have a responsibility to be a leader. Let's take that responsibility, lovingly care for our families, lead them the way we ought to. So we understand, again, if you turn to Luke chapter 6 in verse 35. Luke chapter 6 in verse 35, men and women, spiritual equals before God. We have examples in the scripture like Deborah, outstanding leader among the people of God. Sometimes it's been said, without scriptural backing, unfortunately, even in the church of God, well, the reason Deborah was in charge in ancient Israel was because there were no men man enough to lead. A nice theory. That's simply not what the scripture says. Deborah was just an outstanding woman whose judgment was highly held by the individuals of the nation, and they came to her. God used her very powerfully. Women are to be spiritual equals to men. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a family structure that places the man in charge of that family with ultimate responsibility to lead that family, to guide that family. But when it comes to spiritual potential, each of us has responsibility to develop that relationship with God to be a part eventually of God's family. That's what Genesis 1 means. That's what Paul mentions in 2 Corinthians. And here in Luke chapter 6 in verse 35, Christ says this, but love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. Does that refer only to men? Or is this a human principle? It's a human principle. Women likewise have to love their enemies. They have to do good. They have to lend, hoping for nothing in return. And your reward will be great. And then it says this, you will be sons of the Most High. Sons means descendants. It's children. It doesn't necessarily mean males. You'll be family members is what God is saying. So this is a responsibility for both men and women. Goes on to say, for he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore, be merciful just as your father also is merciful. something we'll talk about at some point in the future, is why is the family under such terrible attack? Why do we not have normal, happy families represented in media today? Why do we have things like the new normal, which is the new abnormal? It's ungodly. You don't find in entertainment anywhere that I can think of. Now, maybe I obviously don't watch much, but the point is I can't think of one normal family that's represented in media. Whether it's movies, whether it's television, whether it's entertainment, video games, it's just not there. Somehow it's just been completely removed from our culture. In our Church of God marriage ceremony, we say this, quote, "The woman was made equal to the man in spiritual potential, the perfect complement to her husband. As such, she was made from the very flesh and bone of man." Now again, there are roles in marriage. And that's a topic for an entirely different sermon altogether. But when it comes to spiritual potential before God, both can enter the family of God as children of the Most High. And when we understand that in the kingdom, when we are spirit beings, as Matthew says, there are no males and females. We are children of God. It's a different kind of existence. The kind of separation or differences we see in the physical will simply not be present in the spirit. Then we understand that these roles now are to help us learn character lessons so we can prepare for the family of God. But both husbands and wives, both men and women, have the same spiritual potential before God to be born as His children into His family. Let's then go back to Genesis chapter 1 for point number 20. And again, I know much more could be said about some of these things. We'll not take the time to do that now. Point number 20, humans were to reproduce. You think, why on earth do we have to say that today? Well, this past few years has seen the lowest birth rate in the history of our nation. The lowest ever. And it's extremely low among certain cultural groups, of which, frankly, most of you fall. Extremely low. So why would we say humans should reproduce? Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28. As soon as God says, "Let us make man in our image," we read in verse 27 where He created them in His own image, male and female. The first thing He says is to do what? Reproduce. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it." The earth needs to be subdued. It needs to be improved. It needs to be beautified. It needs to be made better. "Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves on the earth. Have children." And again, you might say, why do we have to say that today? Because our culture, in general, teaches exactly the opposite. That children, really are a choice. And usually, the fewer children, the better. Children really are a bother. Some of you are old enough to remember way back when an individual by the name of W.C. Fields, an entertainer from the, 30s? It's a long time ago. What was one of his classic lines to children? "Get away from me, kid, you bother me." "Get away from me, kid, you bother me." And that is the cultural norm. Children are a bother. They take away from personal happiness. What strikes me as almost unbelievable are these, I don't know, I hate to even use the word because it sounds so bad, but it's asinine. These asinine articles that will say, "Do you know how much it costs to raise a child today?" It's absolutely ridiculous. I listened to the radio yesterday, brought it up again. I had a different quote here that I'll read to you in a moment. But this woman in New York City, I'll get to that in a minute. Of course, it was on PBS, where else? But according to Investment News, their article, "How much does it cost to raise a kid?" Their estimate, $235,000, not including college. That is so ridiculous, it's not even funny. What's the purpose of an article like this? The underlying purpose is to encourage you not to reproduce. Satan hates the fact that human beings have been given that part of the image of God. Part of the image of God is being able to reproduce after yourself. Satan hates the fact that humans can reproduce because he hates humans, because he hates God's plan. So he will inspire asinine things like this to convince people that you can't even afford to have kids. Pray tell, how have all of us survived? My parents had 5 kids, and I don't know that my dad ever made $235,000 in his lifetime. You gotta be kidding me. Here's what it says. A middle-income family may spend $234,900 to raise a child born in 2011 to the age of 18. That's a 3.5% increase in a year, according to a government report. How do they figure that? You've got to be kidding me. You have got to be kidding me. Expenses, oh, here we go, for child care. Okay. So if I'm going to spend, what, $90, $100, $200 a week for somebody else to raise my child for me while I go work? Yeah, okay, that's a problem. Should we be doing that? You have to answer that question. Should I have children, then dump them off on somebody else to raise? Is that a wise principle? Why am I having children if I'm dumping them off to somebody else to raise? Well, no, I don't want them to raise them. I just want to watch them for 12 hours a day. Well, excuse me, how many hours are they awake? Maybe 16 or 18? Come on, people, we understand this. Expenses for childcare and education, transportation and food represent the biggest jumps, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said today in a report. Adjusted for anticipated inflation, a child in a middle-class family would cost $295,560 to raise, the department said. Then this, notice this phrase, just striking. It's not just the cost, it's the pressure. You see, kids are a pain in the neck, and they create such pressure amongst us. What a sad statement, said Ellen Galinsky, president of the Families and Work Institute based in New York. Competitive educational environments and awareness of what it takes for children to succeed are prompting more spending, she said in a telephone interview. I remember we were amazed when our little daughter was about, I don't know, what was she, 2 years old? We put her in a class. We thought, oh, it would be kind of fun to put her in a little dance class. And to find the competitive attitudes of some of these parents, like, well, you know, we got to buy the best tutu for this little chicky doll. She's 2 years old. Let her tumble on the floor and have fun. What is this? Going through hours and hours of here's position one, here's position two. Let the kid have some fun. Relax. But this intense, what a world we've built. The typical two-parent, middle-income family spent $12,290 to $14,320 in 2011 on each child, the study found. What are they doing? Households that make less, U.S. Day researchers said, households that make less spend less. Surprise, surprise. That shouldn't be rocket science, should it? A family earning less than $59,410 a year, which is probably most of us, will probably spend $169,000 in 2011 dollars to rear a child, while parents earning more than $100,000 may pay $390,000, according to the study. On what? It is just a lie. I mean, it's just such a misrepresentation. It's not funny. And the design is inspired by, they don't know they're being used by Satan, but the design is to not have children. How will Israel be put under? One way is by not reproducing after itself. It's one of the ways. It's sheer numbers in some cases when it comes to the physical. But this New York Times article just put me over the top. This young woman in her 20s wrote the article titled, this is in last week's New York Times, "Opting Out of Parenthood with Finances in Mind." Now, what I want you to see is, I'll just read one paragraph here. What is her priority? Ask yourself that question. I'll tell you what it is. It's stuff. If I have a kid, all the things I want have to be put on hold or simply put aside. What is the number one issue? It is selfishness. So society is constantly encouraging you to be selfish so that you don't reproduce. It's a sad commentary. Here's what she says. Most people want to be sure they can buy and pay for a home, save up for an emergency fund, and enjoy a comfortable retirement. What's she interested in? My personal comfort. My pleasure. Stuff that I want. Selfish. Absolutely selfish. They will go, she continues, to great lengths to meet those goals, and they make life choices accordingly. My husband and I, both in our late 20s, share those kinds of goals with others like us, but it seems obvious that the single decision that can best help us achieve them is one that many newly married, affluent young adults don't usually consider. Don't have children. You see, if you want to get what you want, the first thing is don't have kids. Now, I believe that's a direct disobeying of God's commandment. Now, you may say, well, you know, you can choose to have children when you want and things like that. And that's all true. One of the basic things God tells human beings to do is reproduce. Why? Because we learn so much from it. It is a God-like ability to be able to reproduce. And the things that we learn about self-sacrifice, about giving up what we might like for the benefit of someone else, happens in the family. I'll tell you, this woman in her 20s isn't going to learn any of that. She's not sacrificing for anybody. I want a nice house. I want a savings account. I want a comfortable retirement. What's it all about? It's about me. I wish I could talk to her. So what are you thinking? I don't think she'll call me. She says, for her to have a child will cost her and her husband $1.7 million. You've got to be kidding me. Now, can I say that this person is an idiot without being too rude? I mean, come on. And people are going to buy that. I mean, there was this interview saying, oh, I didn't realize it could possibly cost you that much. What are you thinking? Is this person even going to make $1.7 million in their lifetime? Probably not. I think she and her husband, what, $100,000 a year or something they're making? They're not even going to make hardly that much in their entire lifetime. How could it possibly have a child cost that much? It's all artificial. It is all designed to keep people selfish. You see, if I don't have children, I never have to sacrifice. I never have to give up something that I want to provide for them. It is selfishness. Now, sometimes there are reasons beyond that that people don't have children. We understand that. I'm certainly not saying that it's a terrible sin if someone cannot have children, does not have children for various reasons. Sometimes there are very good reasons. Health might be one of those considerations. But in general terms, we're commanded to reproduce because we will learn so much. I can honestly say, I know my wife would agree, that we have probably learned more about life and about Christianity, about God's way of life by having children than any other event that we've ever been involved with. Now, caring for God's people is close up there, second. But having children forces us to face some issues that we would never face otherwise. We just wouldn't have to. I mean, things like, where do I live? You know, for a couple that doesn't have children, well, a lot of that doesn't matter. We start having children. Ooh, I have to start thinking about somebody else. I have to start being concerned outwardly for others. So one of the reasons I believe God told us to reproduce is that he wants us to step away from ourselves, to look out for others, to care for others. It's an automatic program that is designed to help us be outward, outgoing concern for others. We learn that by having children. And it is an awesome thing. Now, is that saying that everything about children is awesome? We all know the answer to that. I've often said there's nothing that can pull us through the knot hole backwards more than our children. You understand the analogy? It's an old fence analogy from back home. You know, get a knot hole in a fence, a small little hole in the fence, our kids will yank us through that backwards every time. And it will feel like we've just been pulled through a knot hole backwards. But they can also provide some of the deepest joys and greatest rewards that are possible in this human life. There's nothing like looking into the eyes of your daughter when she has an exciting thing to relate to you. Or to give that big bear hug to a son for some accomplishment he's been able to earn or to make. Nothing like it. We learn more almost than any other activity. It's an awesome thing. It is a great thing. Yes, it is filled with self-sacrifice. It is filled with giving. But that's precisely the design of it. So, have more children. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing. Learning to care for them, teaching them to care for each other. Some of the first lessons on selfishness are taught between brothers and sisters. Share with your brother. Share with your sister. Give her some of that. Give him some of that. Settle down. Control your temper. Yes, they did something wrong. Deal with it. Calm down. Lots of character lessons. They're all learned in the family. Ideal place to do that. So one of the ways that we're made in God's image, in his likeness, is our ability to reproduce. And family and reproduction in the family is designed to be a small flesh copy, a dirt copy, a cardboard copy of God's reproducing himself through human beings. So family is vital. It's important. Do not give in to the cultural influence of selfishness that says, don't have children. It's way too expensive. You know, somehow we've all been here. We've all gotten here. And we do a fine job. You know, it's not necessary to spend $1.7 million to have a kid in New York City. The people on the street that do a lot of it, you know. Of course, the old saying, the rich get richer and the poor have children. That's maybe true. But somehow they raise them. So one of the great godlike abilities we've been given is that of reproduction. Let's go on from there. Number 21. Number 21, eat a balanced diet. Eat a balanced diet. You're talking that there's instruction about eating in the book of Genesis? Right after God says, I made you in my image, both male and female. I want you to reproduce and take control of your environment, subdue it, care for it, make it good. He says, oh, by the way, I want you to eat properly. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 29. God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, every bird of the air, every creature that creeps on the earth, which is life, I have given the green herb for food. And it was so. There are some denominations, won't name them specifically here, who believe that this is God's primary instruction about eating. Now, what is not mentioned here? What's left out? When we think of what we had for breakfast or for lunch or what we'll have at the potluck tonight, if we're lucky, because that's what a potluck is all about, what's missing? Meat. No meat mentioned. So there are some denominations that teach that there was an Adamic diet. There was an original diet that God intended for human beings. and it did not include meat. And so they teach as a tenet of their faith that vegetarianism is what God designed for human beings, based on this instruction here. So they simply say, all God said was eat green herbs. So I'll read to you one of the statements from their 27 beliefs of their fundamental beliefs. It says this, to the first couple, the Creator gave the ideal diet. I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. Genesis 1, verse 29, from the NIV. After the fall, God added to their diet. You'll see this occur after the fall. In other words, after Adam and Eve sinned, then God modified things. But he never intended for people to eat meat. After the fall, God added to their diet the plants of the field, from Genesis 3:18. The diet God ordained in the Garden of Eden, the vegetarian diet, is the ideal. But sometimes we cannot have the ideal. Now, I read this, and I say, I know lots of people in this church, and almost everyone that I know does not follow vegetarianism. So what they're saying is that this is kind of what you're supposed to do, but nobody does it. So how do we say it? Well, you know, not everybody can do it. The diet God ordained in the Garden of Eden, the vegetarian diet, is ideal, but sometimes we cannot have the ideal. In those circumstances, in any given situation or locale, those who wish to stay in optimum health will eat the best food they can obtain. What a statement that is. We want you to eat vegetarian. We know none of you will, so eat the best you can. I mean, it's pretty, not much leadership there. I mean, if you either believe it and you teach it and you tell people this is what you should do, or you abandon it. You don't play the middle of the road here. So, meat is not mentioned. What else is not mentioned here? No beverages are mentioned. So did God mean that all you should be eating are those green things that bear seeds and bear fruits? What about drinking water? What about something like the land flowing with milk and honey? That's not mentioned here either. Is that only allowable after sin? You see, because most then will reason. They'll go on to reason that, you see, after human beings sinned and were thrown out of the garden, then God said they could eat meat. Well, wait a second. It doesn't make a lot of sense. What we understand is a basic principle. This is one of the reasons I'd like to focus on this. There's a basic principle of understanding the Bible. And that is, we take all the scriptures about a particular topic and analyze them as a group. And from that group, we come to a knowledge of the truth. We don't take one particular scripture of and by itself and say, that's the truth. And then maybe we'll figure out what the rest of this stuff is all about. We take the whole group. So simply because only green things with seeds and fruits are mentioned here, to make the assumption that that's all God intended us to eat is a mistake. We take all the scriptures together and then discern what God's teaching is. Now let's look at this for one more moment. If we make the assumption that this was God's only instruction to human beings about eating, that means they shouldn't drink because it's only talking about what you should eat. It doesn't mention water or milk or juice or any of those things. So you shouldn't do any of those things. Secondarily, is it an inherently true statement to say, I have given you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth? Did God mean that? Is that what is meant by this? Okay, let's look at that. Poison oak produces fruit and seed. Is that supposed to be on our diet? Poison ivy produces berries containing seeds. Poison sumac has those beautiful drooping clusters of white berries that maybe you are all too familiar with because you didn't know what they were at first. How about something simple, green herb called hemlock? God intend that for food? We're supposed to be eating that? It says every green herb is for your food. How about the strychnine plant? That'll kill you pretty quickly. You can go out and chew on your Japanese yew or your English yew. You know those bushy ball plants out in front of your house that the deer love to chew up and take away? You'll be dead in about an hour if you eat the fruit or the seeds off of those. How about the narcissus? We commonly call that family beautiful, beautiful yellow flowers in the spring, daffodils. The bulbs will kill you if you eat them very quickly. Oleander. How about those beautiful plants we all love to see in the spring? We go driving by to see these beautiful rhododendrons and azaleas. Chew on those for a while. They will kill you. Highly toxic. Did God mean, I want you to eat every single green thing in the world? Of course not. That's not what he meant. He's giving a principle. I put you on the earth. I've given you dominion over it. Eat the green stuff here. Now, are we against eating green things? Well, of course not. But he didn't tell us everything in one single verse. He didn't say, oh, by the way, you chew on some of these things, they will kill you. Now, didn't you wonder who figured all those things out? I mean, who was the guinea pig? Okay, Billy, you eat this. Let's see what happens to you. Or did they just take the prisoners or the convicts or something? I don't know, feed them. That often was the case with medical experiments throughout the ages. You wonder if that wasn't part of it. Or was it just by chance? I'm starving, you're starving, we're walking through the woods, I chew on this, I drop dead. I don't think I'm going to eat that anymore. The point is, God did not give all dietary laws in one single verse in the first chapter of Genesis. He gave the basic principle. Now, we have always taught as a church that it's important to eat what spoils before it spoils. Medical science has clearly understood that green things are good for us. They're good for building health. Not all green things, certain green things. Some of you might not be very allergic to poison ivy. I am. I look at it and I break out. Okay, that's an exaggeration. Point is, some are highly allergic, some less. I had a friend in his 90s that we rented a home from years ago. And he had a fence post in his horse pasture that he allowed poison ivy to grow on it. And I said, you want me to get rid of that poison ivy? No, that's my blood purifier. Really? Yeah, you eat the little leaves that are about the size of your pinky nail when they're fresh and small and purifies your blood. Well, I remember somebody else had heard that and tried it, and their entire throat broke out in this horrible rash from that toxic oil that was on that tiny little leaf. So thinking, boy, I'm not going to do that one. I think my blood's pure enough. Thank you very much. Some of you may have burned poison ivy and inhaled the smoke. You can get the same thing, this horrible rash breaking out in your throat, your lungs, because of that toxic toxin that's on those leaves. So God did not intend that every green thing be eaten. But God is simply saying, the things on the earth I've created for food, they're good for you. Sort out which ones are good, which ones are bad. Now you hope that God might have given Adam some instruction to say, look, I've created this. Don't eat that. It's for a different purpose. It's either for beauty, it's for medicines, it's for other things, but it's not to be eaten. Now, some will say, look, every single thing is good for something for human beings. And that may be true. But this is specifically saying this is for, as the King James says, for meat, for food. So to say that, oh, God did intend vegetarian first for everyone and all the other things are medicine. No, he just says for food, for your diet. So one of the statements about food is that green things are good to eat. How about our beloved buckeye here in Ohio? I chew on a buckeye? Obviously not. The USDA writes this, poisonous plant. All parts of the plant, leaves, bark, fruit, are highly toxic if ingested. Symptoms are muscle weakness, paralysis, dilated pupils, vomiting, diarrhea, depression, paralysis, and stupor. Some of us get that without eating Buckeyes. Many landowners have eradicated it to prevent livestock poisoning. Native Americans, it says, ground Buckeye to use as a powder on ponds to stun fish. You get too lazy to fish, you grind up the Buckeye, throw that in the water, and they start floating up because they're in a stupor. It's a lazy man's way of fishing. Put you in mind of the person who fishes with dynamite, right? You know the old story. So it's not simply every green thing designed for food. It's a general statement to simply say green things, part of the creation, is there for you to eat. Turn over to Genesis chapter 9 in verse 3. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 3. Again, here's a general statement. In the same way that God said, every green thing's there for you, he says this, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. What? Does that mean there are no restrictions about meats that we eat? Here it says every green thing. Now again, the way this denomination I referred to earlier, who also happens to keep the Sabbath, the way they refer to, after sin, then God expanded that to all these other moving and living things. Well, is that the case? Or is it simply saying you can't say everything in one spot, so you say it in a few spots. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Can we list any number of things that will likewise poison us and kill us if we eat them? Things that move? Oh, sure. Lots of those. You can fish them out of the ocean and die eating them. You can get them off the land and die eating them. How about some poison mushrooms? You want to try a few of those? No, not every living thing. He's simply saying, on the earth, I've created food for you as well. It's among the plants. It's among the living things, the animals as well. It says this, I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. In other words, in the same way that you have to selectively eat from the green herbs, you can also selectively eat from the living things. It's okay. I put it there for food. Verse 4, but you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Aha. So we see that there's even a restriction there. Do not eat blood. Toxins and other things are carried in the blood. It's just not good for you. Turn over to Genesis chapter 7, back a page. Genesis 7 and verses 1 through 3. See, Genesis 9 seems to say that you can eat anything you want. If it moves, if it crawls, turn over that rock and eat those slimy little things that crawl out from under there. It's okay with me. No, it's not. Genesis chapter 7, when God put Adam on the ark, he gave him very specific instructions about things that were clean and things that were unclean. This is in the book of Genesis, long before any instruction by Moses to the Israelites about clean and unclean meats. Genesis chapter 7 and verse 1, then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Verse 2, you shall take with you seven each of every clean animal. Now, the typical description is simply all the animals went in two by two, and that's technically true. But there were seven pairs of clean animals and only one pair of unclean animals. Now, it doesn't tell us here what is clean and what is unclean. That's left to elsewhere in the Scripture. So, okay, does this mean, seven pairs of animals who took a bath and one pair of animals who didn't take a bath and were not clean? No. Noah had to be told, and this was probably passed down through generations. God may have given them in specific, but it probably passed down through generations what was clean and what was unclean. So Noah was told, take seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also, seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. So, clean by sevens, pairs of seven, seven pairs, and then unclean one. Why? Clean animals would have been used for sacrifice. They would have been used for food. So God wanted to be sure there was a greater supply of those for you budding mankind once Noah got off the ark. But what we clearly see is that God in certain places gives specific portions of instruction. We put that instruction together. We put Genesis 1 together with Genesis 3, together with Genesis 9, together with Genesis 7. And we begin to see this picture that God has made food for human beings on the earth. There's some of it green. There's some of it living. When you kill it and eat it, don't drink the blood. Don't cook it with the blood in it. Get the blood out of it. There's stuff in the blood I don't want you to eat. There's special significance to that blood. But there are some animals that are clean and some that are unclean. Don't eat the unclean ones, but go ahead and eat the clean. Now, if we turn to Leviticus chapter 11, we have further instruction about the diet God intended for human beings. We won't take much time to go through this, but simply refer to it. Leviticus chapter 11. You probably have written in your margin here Deuteronomy chapter 14, because both chapters in the scripture delineate what is clean for human beings to eat and what is unclean. Now, God doesn't give us a list of the green, clean, and unclean. We had to figure that out apparently ourselves. Lord spoke to Moses, and Aaron said to them, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the beasts which you shall eat among all the beasts that are on the earth." Now, somehow, Noah already knew this. But Moses had it delineated. God specifically spelled it out so Israel would have no question about that. Now, it may have been knowledge that was partially lost during the time of their captivity in Egypt. So God clarifies it once again. Verse 3, "Whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed, and chews the cud among beasts that you shall eat." So the bottom line, it has to have a split hoof and it has to chew cud. And there are specific biological things that go on in these animals that make their flesh better for human beings than those animals that don't have that. Verse 9, "These shall you eat of all that are in the waters, whatever has fins and scales in the waters, and in the seas, and in the rivers, them you shall eat." You're allowed to eat. So the things that have skin and live in the water, and no scales, don't eat. The things that have shells in the water, don't eat. We've often teased about that. Mussels and clams and stuff like that. Those things that have shells, oysters, etc., they are the pool filters of the world. God created them to filter water. Now, do you go to your pool and take out the filter and munch on that and say, "Wow, that's tasty"? And what's it designed to do? It's designed to collect the trash, get it out of the pool. And that's what these shellfish are designed to do in the oceans, to clean up the trash. Now, you eat the trash bin? No, you don't. You respect it for what it's been created to do, but you don't eat it. Now, it goes on to say fowls. Verse 13, among the fowls. He doesn't give a list here in quite the same way. He simply gives examples of the kind of birds not to eat and the kind of birds to eat. And he leaves it to human beings to sort out what are the differences in these animals, in these birds. What characteristics does this list have versus the characteristics of that list? So then any birds who have the characteristics of those clean ones listed would be clean. The ones who have the characteristics of the unclean ones are unclean. So that gives them principles to use by. He also talks about insects. No, you shouldn't turn over a rock and eat whatever crawls out. If you're going to eat creepy crawly things, they need to have legs higher than their bodies, like grasshoppers and crickets and things like that. So if you're really hungry, you even know what's clean among the insects. So if man was never designed to eat flesh, why did God give us canine teeth for tearing and ripping flesh. Pretty obvious. He designed us to eat meat. Why was Jesus Christ represented as a lamb, Passover lamb? Well, because God expected that we would eat fish, we would eat flesh, we would eat animals. Properly done, yes. Christ ate meat. He even cooked fish for his disciples. If it was wrong, if that was somehow incorrect, if that was somehow inferior and only to be done after people sin, then why did Christ do it with his disciples? It doesn't make sense. It's a nice theory to say, oh, God intended vegetarianism. It's just not true. Now, is it true that maybe Americans eat far too much red meat, fat, etc., etc.? The answer is probably yes to all those questions. But to use that and simply say, therefore, God intended vegetarianism is not true. Now, can people be vegetarians and be all right? Probably. So long as they're not missing some very, very important nutrients that come from flesh. So we've often talked in the church about sometimes vegetarians lack some very important things in their diet. So we have to be very careful. So we're not against vegetarianism in principle when health demands it. But we're simply saying that it's not what God intended for all human beings for all time. God expected that we would eat a balanced diet. So with that, we've come to the end of chapter 1. It's only taken us 7 sermons. So with approximately, 30 verses? I think that's what it was. I didn't figure that out before we left. Yes, 31 verses. That means we've covered 31 divided by 7. We've covered almost 4 verses a week. That's a pretty good average. So next time, we will cover Creation Story, Part 2.